the U.S. Supreme Court announced something of a first a week ago. The justices released a code of conduct document, stating that while the court has been following common law ethics rules from a variety of sources, quote, the absence of a code has led in recent years to the misunderstanding that the justices of this court, unlike all other jurists in this country, regard themselves as unrestricted by ethics rules, unquote. That announcement, though, didn't come until after reporting from ProPublica about luxury travel by some justices and other campaigns to influence the court, which were previously undisclosed. Add to the mix pressure from Senate Democrats related to transparency and ethics rules. We're going to get into what all the justices included in this ethics code and what's missing. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. How ethical do you see the Supreme Court as being as of late? Do you think they need to codify a set of ethical guidelines? What questions do you have about what's in this code, what's not in it? What's your response to the court issuing this code of ethics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Benesch is associate professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where she researches judicial decision-making and court legitimacy. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what was your reaction when this ethics code came out from the court about a week ago?
Well, I think there's some cause to be, you know, sort of excited about the fact that the court was listening. So it certainly heard complaints by politicians, concerns raised by the public, and commentators' criticisms of the court's lack or seeming lack of some ethical guidelines. And so the fact that they responded is a big deal. But I think when you read the actual statement and the actual code, you come away a little bit maybe less impressed with their work.
Yeah. What do you think is, first off, what's missing from this document?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's clearly the case that there's no enforcement mechanism here. So the Supreme Court has not offered us any way to make a complaint or allowed any other lawyer or justice to make a complaint against another justice for behaving in ways that are contrary to the code. So that's, I think, the first thing that you notice. I think the second thing, though, is, and maybe this is the first thing you notice, is right on the front, there's this little statement, and you quoted from it in your introduction. And the statement reads to me as sort of a, okay, you're complaining, and we hear you complaining, and so here's what we've already been doing, and stop misunderstanding, you know, our actions. And so it reads as a very sort of, I don't know, I want to say maybe condescending a bit. Saying that, you know, the Supreme Court should be trusted to do these things, and oh, some people are complaining, and so we're going to put some of these things in writing.
And could you talk a bit more about what you see as the motivations for the court to create this document? Why right now?
Well, as you mentioned, the Senate is talking about these ethics considerations, and we're considering some subpoenas for some of the supporters of Thomas and Alito that have led to some of those problematic relationships. And so I think that, you know, they are seeing the political action in Congress. I think they also have concerns about the separation of powers, and some of those concerns may be warranted. And so they wanted to act before Congress attempted to act to constrain their behavior. And then I do think that, you know, especially the Chief Justice, but all the justices are concerned with their legitimacy. And so it seems as if this is a bit of a reaction to some pretty low poll numbers that the court has been experiencing for the last term or so. And I think this is sort of a way to try to allay the concerns of public about their behavior and to sort of put these kinds of allegations and concerns to rest so that people can start to trust the institution again.
And it is pretty rare for there to be a unanimous decision of any kind from the Supreme Court these days. But here, all the justices are signing on to this code of ethics. What do you make of that that consensus from the justices?
Yeah, I think the unanimous nature is important. I think they had to come out with a statement that they all agreed with. But I also think that that's likely why some of the statement is much more vague than it might have been had there been, you know, some dissensus allowed. So, you know, there are a lot of the words in the statement, for example, talk about, you know, should rather than shall. Some of the words talk about using specific things as guidance. And so I think the vague wording of a lot of the code, although it relies pretty heavily on the lower court code, but some of the wording I think is likely a result of that desire for consensus. And so when you want to have a document that all nine can sign on to, you know, you might have to have a document that's a little less specific than maybe some of the justices would have preferred.
We're talking with Sarah Benesch right now, associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at a newly released Code of Ethics from the U.S. Supreme Court. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones right now. We have Ted with us in Monaco. Hi, Ted.
I think it's well documented throughout history that the Supreme Court, not only being the last word of the law, the most trusted branch, they definitely have always been the most ethical branch of government. And the idea of the Senate, where all the, you know, overlooked insider trading and all the outright crime in the executive branch, the idea of some other body of government trying to impose, they're the one that started this, to get rules on the Supreme Court, that's a joke. And it's just some propagandist trying to change the subject because they don't agree with some recent Supreme Court rulings.
Ted, thanks for the call. And Ted's right. Supreme Court, not the only branch of government that faces concerns about corruption and ethics. Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the oftentimes when we criticize the Supreme Court, the real criticism is that we don't like the decisions that they're making. It's less about the process and procedure. And there are, as I mentioned, separation of powers concerns. And so the Supreme Court is the court of last resort. There is no authority that can overturn its decisions. And so, we probably can't expect the court to cede control over its activities outside of the bench to one of the other co-equal branches. I think that separation of powers argument was very important to the Supreme Court, which is another reason why they got ahead of Congress. But I also think there's some real concerns about ethics violations here, especially when we have an unelected body that has life tenure, right? So if we're upset with some of the problems in Congress, we can vote them out, right? We can't do that with the Supreme Court. And I think, frankly, people have higher expectations for the Supreme Court in terms of their honesty and ethics.
And some of the incidents that were reported on by ProPublica and other outlets had to do with Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, accepting luxury travel and gifts from conservative donors. And that was part of the impetus for people really pushing for some kind of ethics code from the Supreme Court. Does this new ethics code laid out by the court address those kind of instances? Would it do anything about that?
I think it does, yeah. I think the code says explicitly that the Supreme Court is going to abide by those lower court codes from the judicial conference. And part of the judicial conference's codes talk about the disclosure of financial gifts. And in fact, it recently made a revision in reaction to some of these questions about the justices to define what personal hospitality means. So there's a exemption to reporting requirements for what they call personal hospitality. And so the question, especially in the Justice Thomas case, was whether or not personal hospitality extended to something like a luxury cruise or a stay at a luxury resort. And so the judicial conference has decided that what they mean by personal hospitality is the justices don't have to disclose when they go over to a friend's house for dinner. We want them to be able to have normal lives and lead, you know, public normal lives. But it does not exempt from disclosure the kinds of trips that Justice Thomas went on, or the kinds of trips that Justice Alito went on. And so I think it's implicitly saying that what they did should have been disclosed. But certainly, again, there's no enforcement mechanism here, so there's no going back. The code only applied to the Supreme Court once it decided it applied to the Supreme Court. And so to the extent that those behaviors are problematic, they're sort of outside the purview of this new guidance.
And as I read through this document that's been put out by the court, I see the word should a lot. Mm-hmm. And I am not a legal expert, but I imagine that justices choose their words pretty carefully. Is that use of the word should rather than shall or must significant?
Yes. The language in this whole code of conduct is significant because it is, you know, as we talked about, a unanimous document that ends up then, because of the unanimity, being a little bit vague and a little bit careful with some of its language. So should and shall is a big distinction, right? So when you say someone should do something or ought to do something, that's much different than saying that someone shall do something. And so there's a lot of room throughout the document for justice choices, and a lot of focus on knowingly engaging in certain behaviors. And so there's a section on financial interests. And so instead of just, you know, sort of saying if there's a financial interest, the justices may not sit on a case, it says that if the justices knowingly engage with a case in which they have a conflict, you know, so there's this sort of additional question, not only of should they have gotten involved, but also did they know specifically that they were getting involved in something that they potentially had a conflict on.
We're talking about what prompted the new code of conduct the Supreme Court released just last week and what's in it. Sarah Benish is our guest. She's associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We want you to be part of the conversation, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What's your perception of the Supreme Court these days? Does this new ethics code move the needle on that at all? Do you think it's necessary or is it not needed? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Sarah Benish, associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about a new ethics code the Supreme Court justices formally adopted last week. We're also taking your comments or questions at 800-642-1234. Let us know if you think there's a need for an ethics policy by the Supreme Court. How do you feel about the High Court these days? Do you have faith in the justices? That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I'm calling to say that in the last 2 years, I read an article in the Milwaukee Journal about the fact that the justices at any time can redecorate their offices, including the purchase of any kind of office furniture or equipment they feel they need, and including specially made draperies for the windows. They can do this without having to go through any kind of a bidding process. They just find what they want and buy it, and it's paid for. And this article also pointed out the fact that there are large rooms within the justice building that they rent out for anniversary parties of all kinds, small conventions, weddings, birthday parties, anything they want. They charge the kinds of rent they want, and they get to keep the money, and none of this is passing through any set of financial books. And when I read that article, it made me even more a disillusioned American citizen than I already was.
Nancy, thank you for the call. Sarah, is that something you know about? And what do we know about ethics for personal office expenses for the court?
I don't know much about that, unfortunately, no. I know that the new code of ethics or code of conduct does talk about use of the chambers for things other than judicial duties, and it seems fairly negative about using them for anything but writing opinions and working on cases. But the actual oral argument chamber of the court is sometimes used in some ceremonial sort of extrajudicial ways, and that has gotten some attention in the past as well. So Justice Thomas, for example, holds the Horatio Alger Association induction there. And that's a big, you know, draw for people who are members of that society. And that has been questioned as being potentially problematic in terms of ethics.
Nancy, thanks for that call. And Sarah, we mentioned earlier how this code of conduct helps to define the personal hospitality aspect that we discussed earlier. Are there other things that are significant in here that you see this code laying out that the justices can't do?
I think the Chief Justice or the unanimous court, I guess, altogether lays out that a lot of the things in this code of conduct are not new. And I think that's fair. I think a lot of the items in the code of conduct are items that have always existed in terms of their application to lower court judges. And what the court is doing now is saying, okay, the Supreme Court will also be bound by these various conduct sort of guidelines. But I think what's, so I think we focus a little bit on that financial activities section with the personal hospitality and with financial disclosures. But there's also a very big piece of the code of conduct that is devoted to recusal decisions. And that's a pretty big deal in courts as well, where judges and justices decide for themselves whether or not they can impartially participate in a particular case given, some sort of perceived or real conflict of interest. And so that section of the code of conduct is an important section, and it's also relatively distinguished from the same section that applies to lower court judges.
Another issue people have been talking about in the past couple of years regarding the court is the activity of spouses, particularly because Ginni Thomas, wife of Clarence Thomas, longtime conservative activist and organizer, we've seen her name attached to communications with the White House on January 6th. Is there anything in this code of ethics about spouses?
Yes, there are some pieces of the code that talk about financial disqualification and about recusal that do relate to conflicts of interest that spouses hold. There's nothing in there about that would sort of pertain to Ginni Thomas's political action, but there are some aspects of the code that apply to the justice, but also to the justice's immediate family, including spouse, children, parents, and so on.
And this code, Sarah, as we mentioned, doesn't have a lot of enforcement teeth written into it. I'm curious, though, what could that look like? What could a hypothetical enforcement mechanism look like for a code of ethics for the highest court in the country?
I don't know. I think that's tricky. To the degree that some of the aspects of the code of conduct are based on U.S. statutes, it is, potentially possible for the attorney general to bring charges. Now, that's probably never going to happen and never has happened in the past. And because the statutes don't explicitly often refer to the Supreme Court and its justices, that would be, there'd only be a very limited place for that kind of an enforcement. And so what the court suggests in this document is that they will rely on the guidance of various bodies, including their Office of Legal Counsel and the Judicial Conference and the various subcommittees of the Judicial Conference. So I think, a lot of legal scholars have been sort of thinking about ways in which the court's ethics could be, or their code of conduct could be implemented. And as we said at the outset, it's really difficult with separation of powers issues, unless the court were to create some sort of an ethics committee where claims or questions about disclosure or about recusal could go to that committee. Any other solution really kind of runs into these questions of separation of powers.
And you mentioned earlier, Sarah, that public trust in the court has been falling for a while. We've seen that in polling here in Wisconsin and nationwide, and that predates reporting on hospitality activities from Thomas, Alito, et cetera. Do you think this code of ethics is likely to move the needle on that public trust issue?
I think it depends on how widely the code of ethics is covered. So I think it's great that you're talking about it on your program. I think it's really hard for the public to keep up with events in government, and this could be seen as a very sort of specific and esoteric sort of question, right? Whether or not the Supreme Court has a code of ethics might not be something that plays really strongly across the electorate. So yes, we've seen some legitimacy losses at the Supreme Court. We've seen confidence lower than it's been for a long time. Generally speaking, scholars attribute that to politicization and to political polarization. And I think those explanations for the Supreme Court's lagging numbers are probably a little bit more compelling than an explanation based on ethics. Although, you know, it's been recent enough that we don't have a whole lot of poll data on whether or not people are adversely impacted by these stories about wealthy donors and so forth and the interaction of justices with them. So, you know, I guess the main thing is that, you know, we have to think about what the public is likely to hear and engage with. And the public writ large may not be particularly interested in a code of ethics for the Supreme Court. It might not be something that's really salient to them.
And what are you keeping your eye on next, Sarah, when it comes to either reaction to this code or ethical issues facing the court?
I think we've already seen some change in response to these new understandings of reporting requirements. And I think that's a positive development. You know, so Thomas has recused in a case involving January 6th. Thomas has also disclosed some trip information that he hadn't disclosed before. And so it's possible that the existence of the code and the discussion of the code and this sort of, you know, conscious awareness of the impact of Supreme Court behavior or the potential impact of Supreme Court behavior on the way people see the institution could have a really positive effect in the long term, keeping the justices just sort of in a self-enforcement kind of way, more aware of the activities that they're engaging in and what those might look like outside the court.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. But Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Sarah Benesch is Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We talked with her about what prompted the U.S. Supreme Court to adopt a formal code of conduct last week, what's in it, and what questions still remain about how it will be enforced.